Hi folks, a little bit of housekeeping again before we start this podcast. This is my conversation from Sunday, the 15th of May, which just coincidentally turned out to be the 74th Nakba Day in Palestine with Enes Haman, and we had a great conversation about some of the heaviest of topics. Do give it a listen. It'd be great if you could maybe visit wearenotnumbers.org and support them in whatever way you can. It's a really interesting project. We continue to need your support. These podcasts don't happen without support of listeners. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And just last week, if you were a patron, you would have heard my conversation with Konstantin Gordiev on the property bubble. You would have heard Rory Hearn on the various issues around affordable housing and the terrible, as he terms them, pathetic delivery services on them. There was also a great conversation with Braxton Bevington, a very impressive young man from the Debt Collective in the US, about what is happening there and why it actually matters. And also a conversation with Dr. Joe Murphy-Lawless that I've been on the record saying it was one of the best podcasts I've ever done, and I've done over 1,000. They're all right now available on patreon.com/tortoiseshack. For the price of a fancy cup of coffee or a cheap pint nowadays, once a month, you get access to them as we do them, including the new pods that are coming this week. We have 3 or 4 lined up, including Lebanon, including Ukraine, and going back to the US with John Schwartz once we get the diaries matched up. Listen, folks, thanks for the support. Thanks for listening. Do join us if you can and let other people know. Talk to you soon. Enjoy the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and this morning I am on my own. My co-host hasn't made it along, but look, a bad pain day, I believe, for Mr. Martin McMahon, and hopefully he's on the mend. But we go on, and the reason we are here, it really is... something that we've covered, obviously, listeners will know, we've covered events in Palestine, Gaza, the West Bank, and across the area, the region, for a number of years now. But this last few weeks has been, we've seen an escalation coming up to the end of Ramadan. Then we thought maybe, you know, tensions might actually come down. And then we saw the events of the last week. And it's been troubling, just even looking from afar. But we've been speaking to people throughout the week, but now we're actually ready to talk in terms of what's actually gone on. But you know, before we go there, I'm going to introduce my guest. She's project manager of We Are Not Numbers, and she'll explain what that project is now in a few minutes. It's Enes Faris Hanam. Enes, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. It is my pleasure to talk to you too.
Listen, just on We Are Not Numbers, again, folks, you can check out wearenotnumbers.org, but Enes, will you let listeners know what the project is and how it operates? It's something that, you know, as I put it when we were talking about it, it's about making those stories, putting the person into the words rather than those headlines and the bulletins that we see all the time. But it's so much more than that as well.
Yeah. So at first, the UN Numbers is a project of the Euromed Human Rights Monitor. So we belong to this organization, to the Human Rights Monitor. So this project basically is about telling the stories behind the dead and the injured. I mean, we always hear the stories that this person was killed. These numbers of people were injured, or their houses were destroyed. But we never try to see what is the stories behind those people. I mean, each one of them is a father, is a mother, is a sister, a daughter, or a son, and each one of them is a story in him or herself. So we're not numbers trying to tell these stories in a personal way, to humanize these stories, and to let the people know that those people are actually these people have families, they have lives, they have dreams, hopes, ambitions, and all of them wanted to have a good life in peace, but because of what happened to them, they couldn't do this anymore. So this is part of what we do. And another thing is that we are trying to train these writers. I mean, what we do is that we recruit writers from Palestine, Palestinians, youth, who start to write about their experience in life, in personal life, without having anyone, a third party, to write for them. Because sometimes when you write a story, you have your ideas, you have your thoughts. But when someone else, a third party, comes and writes your story, there has to be some interfere that the writer, him or herself, doesn't want to add. So what we do is that we take these writers, we train them, we give them basic writing skills, we give them creative writing, and then we give them about we train them about human rights, about how to address themselves, how to address Western audience, and then we connect these writers to mentors, to native speakers of the language, who can later just work with them in order to improve the language and the in order to make the idea reach the audience and the world. So this is basically what we do at Word
Yeah, and you've summed it up really well there. But it's so important that when you have, like, I mean, I mentioned before we started recording that the website opens with there's no such thing as the voiceless. They're only the deliberately silenced or the preferably unheard by my favorite writer, Arundhati Roy. And this is what the idea is, to get the message out. And you do have to, sadly, in this modern world, tailor the message so even Western ears can understand it and see it. But like, you talk about the stories, you yourself have told the story of a young man who, he self-immolated. He took his own life by burning himself to death. I mean, these are extraordinarily tragic events that people feel they have no hope, that they feel the whether it's life under the occupation or things that have happened to them leave them with no other choice. And those stories, they need to be told. And you know, we've seen, I know there's we covered one of the books recently that about the shared struggle between as using your body as a weapon to starve yourself while you're in prison in Israel, and how that's got echoes of what happened in Ireland in the H block cells where men went on protest by starving and ultimately dying, making that sacrifice by doing that. If I could though, the mentor thing interests me. So you team them with people who are basically not in Palestine for the most part, but can then train them how to write for a wider audience. Is that my correct understanding?
The mentors are pro-Palestinians. So this is number one. They are pro-Palestinians. They are specialists. So they are specialists in the language. I mean, as writers, they are known and for having their own writings, and they are native speakers of the language. So we have many of them. Like I have for myself, I myself had the Nancy Krikorian. She was my mentor for the first time I started working, and she affected me a lot. She helped me improving very much. Also, Howard Kaplan was my second mentor, and with him, I had the chance to have my story in his book, in his novel, and he used it. Yeah, he used it as an example of how Palestinians see life. So these mentors are not only helping the writer to improve, but they also help him or her in different levels.
Again, it's not nice to turn the conversation like this, but we talk about how things have been seen and been reported, and I know it was actually on your website, it was written about how differently the coverage was. You know, like I read on the BBC World Service a tweet where it said Israeli police involved in clashes with at a funeral, and you're like, it's just stunning. And that's why why the work that you guys do, it matters. It's about getting rid of that awful mealy mouth way of making it seem like, you know, that this was one, both sides were as bad as each other, and that. And of course I'm referring to the tragic murder of Shireen Abalake. But Enes, when I reached out to you, you even said that she was a hero to you and to so many. Can you just share with me, with my listeners, the hurt that you and your friends and your colleagues all experienced when you got the news that tragic morning?
Sure. So her name is Shireen Abu Aqle. Shireen is a reporter at Al Jazeera News Agency, and Shireen was known for all of us as the person who reports for news. I mean, we grow up knowing that this is the only, like in our mind, we thought, or for myself, thinking that this is how you can become a journalist or a reporter, because she was like doing this, Shireen Abu Aqli, Al Jazeera, and everything else. So she has this tone to end her report. And each one, while we were children, I mean, you know, we would be playing, and then we would act like this, and we just stand in front of the mirror and act like her, Shireen Abu Aqli. She was our role model, and we were looking up to her. So waking up into the news that she was killed, murdered, assassinated this way, it was shocking to all of us, because we wouldn't expect that such a reporter who witnesses what's happening, who tells the world what's happening in Palestine, everywhere, has become the victim. She is now killed. So this was shocking to all of us. I mean, Myra and the writers at We're Not Numbers, every one of them wanted to write something about her, because all of them know her. I mean, you wouldn't find anyone who doesn't know Shireen Abu Aqli.
Just on the, say, everybody wanted to write something, even on your Twitter feed, everybody gave a statement. You know, and as you rightly say, everybody knew her. And I mean, everybody knew her and everybody admired her. And I mean, this is a visual, this is an audio podcast, but, you know, Ines was gesturing, almost standing in front of the camera and holding the imaginary microphone. And you can imagine that giving, you know, people an idea of like, well, actually, this woman was so much more than just a journalist. She was also, you know, she was speaking for us. So it was really, really barbaric. And she was, I mean, this has to, the way she was shot, between like where she was shot, that took a level of sophistication whereby it was done intentionally. And, you know, and then you see the events where within hours there's misinformation coming out saying, well, there was people shooting back. It might have been Palestinian forces that killed her. And this is part of the continuous cycle of this. And yet, you know, the Western world, I think this time, had less patience for what was said by the Israeli side. Is that your feeling of it as well?
Yes, I've been talking with this about this with my colleague in the morning, actually, and we said that Shireen's killing, I'm not going to say that killing, is not going to be as anything else has happened, because Shireen's death this time is going to change lots of things. People now can see that this is not only killing to a person, to an individual, but this is aiming or targeting journalism, targeting human rights, targeting the ability or the right to tell what's happening. So and the writing itself. I mean, what was the purpose of killing Shireen? I mean, one would ask, why would you do this?
Just, well, even beyond why they would do this, it seemed to be that, she was deliberately targeted. And this is me talking, like, but it does. And then, you know, to see the video of the young man coming over the wall, trying to help her while she's lying there, it can't help but, you know, speak to the strength of the solidarity. And those scenes then that we witnessed of everybody turning out for this, for the funeral, was extraordinary. But then it was obviously made even worse in terms of the follow-up by the attack on a funeral cortege. I don't know. I'm going to ask you a question. That seemed to me like in Ireland, we take our funerals very seriously. It seemed to me that this was a step too far for, and, you know, I was speaking to Hannah Salah, who we've had on the podcast several times. And she said, you know, that the coffin didn't fall, but the occupation will. And I know that was a lot of defiance, but it was also a lot of heartbreak to see that. Has there been enough, do you think, international outcry? Because when you look at the events, and again, there is war in Ukraine and Russia has invaded, and we see how the West has reacted. And it is not, we're not doing whataboutery. We're not saying that, you know, you can't support Ukraine and you can't, we have absolutely solidarity with people being oppressed everywhere. But, you know, you must look and see that and say, you know, there's not a, where is that international support and outcry for Palestine, and indeed for the decades long struggle now?
Yes, actually, we think about this all the time. We think that why would the world or some news agencies would focus on that Russia is attacking Ukraine and this and that is happening in Ukraine, but at the same time, what's happening in Palestine, no one focuses on. Or they would say that this is happening, but they wouldn't say who is the doer. Like I have two examples, and those you can see in our website. Now the first thing is that when they cover I'm using some of one of our writers who did this investigation.
Yeah,
and he found that the news agencies like BBC, like New York Times, these agencies, they would cover the doer. They wouldn't say who did what. Like all the time, they would say, like New York Times says that a Palestinian journalist was dead on her 51, but they didn't say how she was dead. I mean, dead is like she was on her bed. She was like, she had cancer. She had like this, but she didn't had. But they didn't mention or say that she was killed by Israeli soldiers. While on another news agency, they would say, Russia is attacking Ukraine, but they wouldn't say Israeli soldiers or Israeli forces are attacking Palestine. So why is this? One would think about this.
Oh, absolutely. There was one report from, I think it was MSNBC, where it said killed by fire. Who was firing? You know,
yeah.
It was killed by fire. It was outrageous. Today happens to be, just coincidentally, I didn't realize this when we scheduled this, it's the 74th anniversary of the Nakba. I mean, again, I'm aware of it, but if you could just tell our listeners what that is and what it means, particularly for the Palestinian people and the right to return.
Okay. May 15 annually, Nakba Day marks the 1948 forced expulsion of nearly 800,000 out of 900,000 Palestinians who were forced to leave their houses. That was like 47 years ago. People were living in peace in Palestine, and they were Muslims, Christians, and Jewish. They were living in peace. They were living together, and then all of a sudden, Israel came and with airplanes, with bullets, with guns, with all the weapons that they have, they managed to force all this number 800,000 people to leave their houses and to go into diaspora, to come to Gaza, to go to Lebanon or Jordan or any other places. My father himself is a Palestinian who was forced to leave his house. He was like 5 years old when he was forced. But I can, I heard it from him. I heard from my grandmother as well, because she was the one who did this. And I can imagine that her whole world was turned upside down in one night when the news came that all the people in Jaffa, and because we were in Jaffa, and the neighboring cities have to leave for 2 days or 2 weeks maximum, because at that time they had the news that you will only leave for two weeks or 2 days. Don't worry, just leave your houses and leave, and you're coming back in few time. But they never came back. My grandmother didn't know back then that she's not coming back, and that from now on the word refugee is going to be next to the name of herself, of her children, and of her grandchildren. And that is the name at my next to my ID, refugee.
Yeah. And when you say, you know, we talk about the people who have been displaced, and it's now, you know, they're still holding deeds to houses that are no longer there, having keys to front doors that no longer exist. All of these things that, you know, their connections to their land. Even now, you see in the last few weeks where still knocking down bloody olive trees in you know, coming in and destroying land, making it unlivable, and this situation and in international terms, the agreements that have been made, they've just not been honored, and that every year the Nakba comes back. And I read a tweet from Maha Hosseini earlier, who I spoke to last week, saying that 74 years ago, my family was expelled from Jerusalem during the Palestine Nakba. I've been there twice and denied many permits to visit. They said the old will die and the young will forget. 74 years later, my only dream is to live back where my father was born. We spoke to the Palestinian lowboy Abbasani, who was involved in the Mars helicopter. He's the engineer that helped put a helicopter in Mars, literally on with NASA, working in the US. And he has not been able to even come home because, you know, he studied in the US, and every time he wants to try and come home, he's told, you know, you can go as far as this, but if you go, you might not be able to go back and continue your work. So it's a global phenomenon, and it's a sad, tragic stain on all of us. And it's just in terms of the escalations last year, we saw a real conflict. Really, really tragic events whereby even when we were covering it, I don't know if you'd some of the stuff we did when we were talking to Hannah, bloody missiles were falling, and it was some of the scariest stuff I've ever been involved in. Do you feel now, given how tensions have risen so high and there was a lot of outcry, is there likely to be more trouble, more of a clampdown? Because that would be the concern that I would worry that there will be reprisals now and that there will be more innocent people hurt.
This is actually part of the first question, because now we're saying that the Nakba was in 1948, but no, it has never stopped, because we have been living Nakbas year after another, starting from first Intifada, second Intifada, going attacking or the raids on Jenin in 2002 and Jenin this year, all of the military attacks on the Gaza Strip and on Al-Aqsa, and what's happening to Al-Jarrah. All of these are attempts to take us or to remove us from where we belong. So coming back to your question, we here at Palestine, we really hope that there is no military attacks anymore. We are so much tired of these attacks, of the fear, of the horror, of the destruction, of everything that happens. Seeing our beloved dying, or seeing our beloved injured, or not being able to help or to support. We at the same time, we are not sure, because all the time we would see that there is going to be a military attack, and then it doesn't. And then when we are feeling like, yes, things are going to be peacefully, we are shocked by an attack. So hopefully there is not going to be any attacks, but we don't know.
Yeah, and I suppose it was an unfair question, because it's a lived experience anyway. If there's no missiles firing, there's still a blockade. It still makes life very difficult to get supplies that are needed. It still makes, you know, it makes all of those things, limited access to electricity, limited access to the seas, all of these things. And we just kind of, it's easy for me sitting in Dublin to sort of shrug and take them for granted, but that's the real life experience in Palestine and Gaza. There's a lot wrong, and these are human rights breaches that are happening on a daily basis. So it's not just that. Ines, I'm going to, if you don't mind, just let listeners know that you can support the work of We Are Not Numbers on wearenotnumbers.org, and there's a donate button. It helps those young writers get their start, and you can help them there. Is there any other way that people can support you guys?
We are soon going to start our fundraising campaign, because we are out of money. We are short of money so far. So we at We Are Numbers are trying to. I mean, recently we did this initiative in which we trained writers to write policy paper, and we this is what we keep doing all the time. We are trying to improve their brains, to let them know how to debate, how to know about their human, about their rights and the human rights. We tell them, we encourage them to make their decisions, to improve their personalities. So all of this we do through helping them to write in the first place, because writing for the Palestinians and for in Gaza specifically is a therapy, because this is the only way that we can tell about what's happening to us. This is the only way that we can reach the world and let the world hear our voices, because there is nothing, as you said, there's nothing called voiceless, because everyone has a voice. Mm. Every and each one of us has a voice, but the problem is that they can't hear us. You can't listen or hear the voice because of many things, because of the distractions, because of the people or the media or the things that are blocking our voices to reach you. And yet we are not numbers. We are trying to remove all of these distractions and just go directly to you to let you know what is really happening here in Gaza, in Palestine. So yes.
Thank you so much, Ines Faris Hanam. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast this morning. And I will let you get on with your day. Listeners, we'll be back tomorrow talking the housing crisis again. So it never stops. So thank you for your support. But do check out wearenotnumbers.org, because it's a really, really great way of getting those stories out there, the personal stories, and actually there's a few videos up there as well that Ines has done, and she might not like me saying it, but she is a poet, so she has some really, really good stuff herself. Thanks for listening, folks, and we'll talk to you all very soon. Take care. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.